Good morning. On this Aloha Friday, the IUCN World Conservation Congress is wrapping up its work. Today, we look at the messages members will take home. Director General Inger Anderson lists the wins of the Hawaii commitments and the future challenges. And we get a benediction from the godmother of ocean protection. Dr. Sylvia Earle joins us this hour with her takeaways. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
I'm Bill Sage. New research by the National Park Service on Kamehameha the Great's massive sacrificial heiau, Pu'ukohola, and its secrets.
It's a Friday, September 9th. That's the conversation for this hour, and it starts right after this news. Good morning and welcome to an Aloha Friday edition of The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Bill Sage.
Good morning, Beth Ann. As the week with the IUCN has been around, I remember some people bandying about phrases like evil genius, and I thought, what does that mean? And then I realized because of the IUCN, it belies that whole absolutely erroneous phrase. Genius is never evil. Genius always solves problem. And it is almost mind-blowing to be in the presence of just continuous genius.
Of the folks that we've been able
exactly.
to talk to, whether they're well-known names or whether they're not, being able to solve problems that they've been confronted by in their own locations. And we've been talking to people from around the world dealing with many of the same issues that Hawaii is facing. Well, we're going to continue this conversation with someone who's name is synonymous with genius. For anyone connected with marine preservation, the work of Dr. Sylvia Earle is inextricably linked with the movement that has brought ocean conservation to where it is now. Dr. Earle is the author of more than 200 publications. She's led more than 100 expeditions with over 7,000 hours underwater. She's the founder of ocean research-related companies and foundations, and she has been in love with the ocean for just about as long as she can remember. As the IUCN World Conservation Congress is soon to close, we asked her for her take on what has come out of the Congress and what needs to come out of the ocean preservation community. We're very happy to welcome Dr. Sylvia Earle to our studio this morning. Thank you so much for the time this morning.
Thanks for having me on board.
Your message to all of us for a very long time has been that the ocean is in trouble. As you look at the ocean today, right now, out our windows here, how much trouble are we in?
I say in my lifetime I've witnessed a parallel course. One, we've learned more about the nature, not just of the ocean, but of who we are, where we've come from, and maybe even where we might go in the future and how we could get to a better place than we are. At the same time, we've lost more. We have the power to change not just the land, not just the nature of the skies above, but the ocean. The ocean. We've changed the chemistry of the ocean because of what we've been putting into the sea. The excess carbon dioxide is acidifying the ocean. We've warmed the ocean as well as the rest of the planet, but the ocean has been the great stabilizer, taking up much of the heat generated by the warming that has as its core the burning of fossil fuels, new in mostly the last half century, that we have increased our impact. It's not just what we're putting into the ocean. Oh, the avalanche of debris, plastics, and other materials that did not exist when I was a child. Also, what we're taking out of the ocean.
I want to talk to you about what we're taking out of the ocean. We, here in Hawaii, fish is a very important part of the diet for many people. But for you, you don't eat fish. And you've said that if we only knew, we probably wouldn't eat fish either. What is it about fish that we don't know in the way that many people simply regard them as a commodity?
Well, humankind has a long history of consuming wildlife. I mean, 10,000 years ago, primarily consumed wild creatures for sustenance. But go back 10,000 years ago, our numbers were a few million. When I came on the planet in the 1930s, the numbers were about 2 billion. And now we're edging up toward quadrupling that number in a matter of decades. So 7 billion, and some say that maybe by the middle of this century it could be as many as 10 billion. The planet doesn't get any larger. And for us to survive and thrive, we have become farmers. We've cultivated most of what we now consume, but we still have this deeply embedded habit of taking wildlife. Most people tend not to think of what lives in the ocean as wildlife, bushmeat, if you will, but every wild fish is like a wild bird. Even when my parents were kids, taking wildlife from the skies, wild birds, was a common thing. And some are still, ducks and geese, a few are taken by hunters, but not by the truckload anymore. We've come to see wildlife on the land with new eyes. Yes, most things are edible, but we choose to keep them alive for other reasons. We need to respect life in the sea for more than just commodities. It's been right now we're looking at a transition. Whales once were just regarded as pounds of meat and barrels of oil.
Or tons.
Tons, right. Weighed by the, counted for. And we still look, now we look at fish, not as individuals, not as individual lives, not the way we look at birds, but rather as just commodities, pounds of meat, barrels of oil, the way we used to look at whales. So there is hope that as thousands, millions actually, of divers are out there as witnesses, getting to know ocean wildlife as something other than just a potential meal. But we tend to lump fish together in ways that we don't think of birds. With birds, we think, oh, we know it's a chicken, we know it's a turkey, but we don't think of having Kentucky Fried Bird or a mammal burger. But we do think of, let's have a fish sandwich, or let's have fish and chips, or fish chowder. What of the 33,000 kinds of fish are we talking about? We just sort of lump them all together as fish.
The industries that we talk about when we talk about food, I mean, there's the poultry industry and the meat industry, certainly fish. You've made the point over time that fishing has changed, that, for indigenous cultures that live and need to have...
By the sea,
and they have to have sustenance that comes from the sea.
Right.
Is sort of, one thing, but the way fishing has been industrialized, particularly over the last, 60, 70 years, has also dramatically changed the way the ocean behaves. We've watched Westpac become a member of the IUCN. Do you find a strange irony in that?
Well, it's well to have representation of the many voices that have interest in the nature of the ocean. But what's curious is that we're making decisions about life in the ocean. And we talk about having the stakeholders, the constituents, but most of those who are being affected, that would be life in the sea itself, they may be on the table as lunch and dinner or breakfast, but they're not at the table. And neither are those in the future who will inherit the consequences of the decisions we make now. If we keep taking on the same level that we are now, the trend from the 1950s to the present time is one of consistent, steady, and now precipitous decline. We talk about sustainable fishing, but where's the evidence? right now, in just when I was the chief scientist at NOAA, a piece of paper came across my desk saying that bluefin tuna in the Atlantic had declined by 90% in 20 years. And I attended a fisheries council meeting, and I said, what are we trying to do? Exterminate them? Because if so, we're doing a great job. We only have 10% left to go. That's when they started calling me the Sturgeon General, because I had the audacity to speak up for the fish. Well, now it's not 10% anymore. It's less than that. And they aren't exterminated because there have been efforts to try to have some kind of constraint on how many tons we take. Again, it takes a lot more small tuna than big tuna to make a ton. And we're talking lives here. And it's the big old fish, the ones that we have extracted, basically the distillation, what has taken all preceding history to get into an ocean that was working in our favor, and it's taken us a few decades to unravel these tightly wound food webs, these nutrient cycles, the chemistry of the ocean, by extracting on the order of 100 million tons, we're talking now, how many lives of the shrimp and the crabs and the krill and the oysters and clams and tunas, and in some countries still take whales. And it's just amazing. We have the capacity, literally, to clear-cut the ocean. And so this is not about sustaining needs. This is about money. It's about fostering a commercial extraction of wild creatures on an industrial scale. And it does not show respect for the ocean, let alone up for ourselves as sentient creatures who should look at it and say, this is not working. Fish have values that transcend just something to eat that is largely, for most people, really think about world. It's a choice. It's not a need. For those for whom it is sustenance, for whom it is a need, well, we need to preserve through having large protected areas, because even with relatively simple methods, we can diminish wildlife, but it's understanding what the limits are and working within that framework.
So let's talk about that a little bit. When you talk about having respect for the ocean, understanding that some people have needs, we also know that there are quotas that are sort of being swapped out in a cap-and-trade sort of way, and yet we've just had the expansion of the Papahānaumokuakea Marine National Monument. Some people say, well, you know, isn't there some balance in some of that? And yet when you look at the Marine National Monument, Papahānaumokuakea is only, what, less than, you know, 0.5% of the entire ocean, probably far less than that, literally a drop in the ocean. And then there are these ideas that you can simply, you know, take this place and swap out for that place for, you know, what fishers want to do. How do you create some greater respect for all of this when most people look out and see the ocean as being itself, you know, part of, we talk about the blue economy. What do you do to be able to make people understand that just because it may look like it can resurge and revitalize itself, that perhaps it really isn't, and that there are these situations that you know intimately that the rest of us should?
I think first it's important to recognize that the most important thing that we extract from the ocean, it's not oil, it's not gas, it's not fish, it's not minerals, it's our existence. Our existence, our life depends on maintaining the integrity of the ocean as the cornerstone of our life support system. Generates more than half of the oxygen in the atmosphere. Doesn't matter where on the planet you live, if you've never seen or touched the ocean touches you. Every breath you take, every drop of water you drink. 100 years ago, the idea of protecting special places on the land that had a magnified part of either for their beauty or their cultural or historic significance, the national park system came into being. Really, we just celebrated the centennial of the national parks. Well, 100 years ago, the nations of the world did not have jurisdiction out as far as they now do. In the 1980s, the exclusive economic zone was established, and the idea of blue parks in the second century is taking hold. And the President Bush's action going back toward the end of his administration, and now President Obama expanding the Papahanamakuakea, it's an idea whose time has come to look at the ocean with new eyes, to take care of the ocean, provide safe havens for wildlife in the sea, which means we're providing a safe haven for ourselves on this little blue speck in the universe.
We're down to about the last minute that we have to be able to talk together on air. And I wanted to ask you about the new partnership that you're announcing today between your organization, or one of them anyway, Mission Blue, and its Hope Spots with the IUCN. What will this mean?
The partnership between Mission Blue and the IUCN to create a framework so that individuals, communities can nominate places that they love and that they realize need care. And through their public support, gather data and claim responsibility, take responsibility. We have nominations already for more than 400 places around the world, and we're just developing that framework with IUCN to encourage people to do what they can do as individuals, as communities, and as countries, to step up and say, we care about the ocean, and now we have a way to actually work that process through to officially sort of emulate what has just been done here in Hawaii with this grand new protected area.
Dr. Sylvia Earle, the last 15 minutes have flown by. I thank you so much for the time this morning, and I wish you all the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Dr. Sylvia Earle is the explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, the founder of the Sylvia Earle Alliance, Mission Blue, that we were just talking about, and founder of Deep Ocean Exploration and Research, Inc. She was named Time Magazine's first hero of the planet and a living legend by the Library of Congress, among many, many other awards. She's also the subject of a Netflix documentary, Mission Blue. More about her is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HBR2. It's 8:21. Coming up, the results of what a kahuna told Kamehameha the Great to do. But first, a large flat backyard quiz.
Now, before we head off to Kauaihai and the National Park Service, let's take a trip to another part of the Big Island for the backyard quiz. Like so many settlements in Hawaii, the small town of Pahala was founded to support the sugar industry. Pahala was originally established as a housing camp for workers and managers in the Kau sugarcane fields. The town's location on a flat plateau in the center of the cane fields was ideal to support plantation operations. It also contained a rare fresh water spring. The town was given the name of Pahala by its plantation residents, but for today's backyard quiz, we'd like to know from what does the name Pahala derive its meaning in Hawaiian? You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and if you're first and right, you'll get our T-shirt.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Whole Foods Market Hawaii, Ulupono Initiative, and Hawaii Pacific University.
Hawaii Island Kohala Borna'ali'i Kamehameha was told by a kahuna that he was destined for greatness if he completed a monumental task. He was to build a massive luakini heiau sacred to his war god Kuka'ili Moku. If done, his vision of conquering the Hawaiian Islands and uniting them under his rule would come true. He did, and it did. In 1790 through 91, thousands of Kamehameha's men passed stones by hands in human chains stretching up to 14 miles from the heiau site on the Hill of the Whale, Pu'ukohola. When they finished, a massive stone platform 224 by 100 feet commanded the hill, about a mile from Kauaihai. And current investigations are revealing even more about this kapu place. National Historic Landmarks Program Manager Elaine Jackson Rotondo joins us by phone this morning. Aloha, Elaine.
Good morning.
So this Pu'ukohola Heiau, I've been there, and you can really feel an eerie presence of mana. Can you go into some of the background and what you were hoping to find out more about?
Yes. The Pu'ukohola Heiau is already designated a National Historic Landmark. It was designated in 1962. However, when it was designated, the documentation that was used was very minimal. It's basically 2 pages long, and it doesn't really identify anything other than the Pu'ukohola Heiau and the Malakini Heiau, and it doesn't really define a boundary for that landmark. It says 10 acres. And so the current study is to help improve that documentation, meaning establish a boundary and identify other resources in the area that are nationally significant associated with the heiau.
Now, we have some really good clues because by this time there was Western contact. I believe it was John Young who actually provided cannon for Kamehameha?
John Young also lived near the heiau and provided services to Kamehameha. And with the enabling legislation that established Pu'ukohola Hawaii National Historic Site, mm-hmm. That legislation did recognize and mention the property of John Young. However, the National Historic Landmark, which occurred 10 years earlier, did not.
So that has been corrected. Now, what are you uncovering about as more data is being revealed? Are there anything which previously has not been brought to light that the public is now finding out about the area and its significance?
Well, the study is currently still in draft, the NHL study, mm-hmm. which we're calling an update to the original National Historic Landmark nomination. And so we're not discussing all of the details of that until it actually becomes final draft and is released for public comment.
Well, I noticed that the area when I was there, because the heiau is considered such a sacred site, visitors are certainly not allowed to go up on it, because of what had taken place there, and that will be maintained?
I would, as far as management policies for mm-hmm. the park, that's really under the jurisdiction of the superintendent and other entities, and I actually don't work for the park. I work for the regional office in San Francisco.
I see. Well, in your area of expertise surrounding most of the Pacific areas, there's another heiau which is actually underwater, which is nearby. That is included as part of it?
It was not included in it's unclear whether it was intended to be included in the original documentation. As far as what will be included in the updated documentation, as I said earlier, we have to wait until we have mm-hmm. the complete study and it's released to the public. The study will be very clear about what has been evaluated or found and what is proposed for inclusion within the National Historic Landmark boundary.
But apparently that heiau originally was for sacrifices to the shark god Mano, was it not?
That is my understanding.
And then the Pu'ukohola heiau was actually used because it was dedicated to Kamehameha's war god Kukalimoku. I mean, human sacrifice apparently was a large part of its construction. And if I'm not mistaken, when they built it, they used red lava rock, which is far away from it, just because the red denoted the blood sacrifices emanated in the very color of the stones itself. So all this seems to tie into this very fierce dedication to a god of war, and yet somehow the overall effect was to produce the fulfilling of a prophecy. I'm wondering if this sort of massive historic undertaking will continue to be brought out more so once the documentation becomes public.
Within the National Historic Landmark nomination?
Mm-hmm.
In particular, that's your question?
Yes, ma'am.
I believe so. Like I said, the documentation is not yet finalized. And we do send it out once the documentation is finalized or close to final draft. We do have peer review to ensure that the context and the resources that are identified are within keeping with current knowledge and understanding by scholars in the community. And then once it's peer-reviewed and re-edited, then that's the document that would go to the public.
Great. Well, thank you very much for all your help this morning. Elaine Jackson-Rotondo is a Pacific West Regional Manager for the National Park Service Historic Landmarks Program, which covers the western states as well as Hawaii, Guam, American Samoa, Federated States of Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, Wake, and Midway. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for more details.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from First Insurance Company of Hawaii, providers of auto, home, commercial, and specialty lines of insurance since 1911. First Insurance Company of Hawaii, FICOH.com.
The Western Pacific Fishery Management Council most often advocates for Hawaii's fishing industry, yet it became a member of the IUCN. With that reality check, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann, and happy Friday.
You too. Well, I mean, a lot of people would hear that, and we talked just a moment ago with Dr. Sylvia Earle about that, but it seems like this is a very strange combination.
There are people definitely scratching their head as to why Westpac, as it's known, is now a voting member of the World Conservation Congress, which, of course, as we all noted, is meeting in Honolulu. They finish up tomorrow on Saturday. Why is Westpac there? Its main purpose is to advocate for Hawaii's fishing industry. This is the world's largest environmental conference. Why is a group that's actually opposed to a lot of the key positions that IUCN members take, why is there? Why is it a voting member? That's something that Nick Gruby took a look at in today's story.
So why are they there? What did Kitty Simon say?
Well, they managed to get on there because they feel that they do work with other agencies, and there is indications that they do try and reach compromise. But let's be clear about some of their positions. The Westpac has definitely looked to cut federal protections for green sea turtles. It has advocated for Hawaii fishermen to catch more big eye tuna. They exposed the expansion of Papahanao Mokua Kea. They say it doesn't promote conservation. And you mentioned Sylvia Earle being on the show. Well, guess what? Kitty Simons doesn't think Sylvia Earle and all those other people that wanted to expand Papahanao Mokua Kea know what they're talking about. Their main concern, Westpac in this case, is that fisheries should be well managed. They're primarily worried about a loss of jobs in that industry.
Now, some of this, you know, clearly would be expected because it's an industry trying to promote and protect itself. And
sure.
perhaps going to be, or not perhaps, but definitely going to be at odds with those who say, no, they're really at fault for some of this. We just heard what Dr. Sylvia Earle said a little earlier on the program. So where does this leave Westpac in the context of the IUCN going forward?
That's a good question. There is actually a motion before IUCN this week against overfishing in the oceans. There's even talk about setting aside 30% of the ocean by 2030 to be untouched. Well, as you can imagine, Westpac opposes that. By the way, at their exhibition booth, while a lot of other people are showing pandas and whales and flora and fauna, at Westpac's booth, it's a fishing vessel, longline vessel, and dead tuna being sliced up for auction. So clearly they're showing where their position is.
All right. Not much more we're going to be able to say except for that. Thanks very much, and have a good weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. And now with a look at what's coming out of Hawaii Public Radio's newsroom as we leave the IUCN World Conservation Congress behind and move off to other issues. The environment and conservation is never far from our minds in Hawaii. And
exactly.
We'll have more on that next week.
Exactly. It's such a lingering idea, and a lot of the concepts and thoughts talked about and a lot of folks coming in that you had on the show this week and that we talked with in news pieces and all, really a reminder of how important and how central to our lives here in Hawaii the environment is, and that takes on many forms. One form, just in terms of the caring for the aina, the land here in Hawaii, is farming. And a reminder also this coming week that economics also plays a key role in this. And that's why the Chamber of Commerce of Hawaii is putting together this panel on the future of agriculture in Hawaii. And part of this is looking at, again, just some of the numbers, but also some of the stories of that. You're going to hear from folks at the Hawaii Farm Bureau, Dean Okamoto, the president of Nalo Farms, which is a real, you know, local success story, as you know, and some other farmers as well, and a look at some of the demographics involved. One of the concerns, as you know, in terms of farming nationwide is an aging workforce, but also here in Hawaii, and some of the shifting demographics of that. A lot to look at. So Wayne Yoshioka is going to be looking at that.
We're often told that the average age of a farmer is north of 50.
Yeah.
And although, you know, 50 may be the new 40 or even 35 or whatever, still you're talking about a workforce that needs to replenish itself.
And an interesting time also at a time when we're talking about the end of sugar on Maui, and although sugar has long departed elsewhere, right. But the opportunity of looking at farming also means biofuel crops. It means other things, but food itself and how and what we do to deal with that, you know, big piece of our future.
Right, a big piece of land that's now moving to smaller parcels. Interesting shift. Watching that happen again. Next week, we're also going to check in with Hokulea.
Yeah, so Hokulea has been crossing some, I guess you could say, unfamiliar waters, heading inland. It's still in the east, but it's moving west by river, which is kind of interesting. It's been going through, recently went through the Erie Canal onto Lake Ontario. One interesting part of that is it moved through the whole series of lock systems. It didn't have to pay some of the usual shipping fees because of the canal and the historical nature of the canal. Hokulea is considered as a barge, so it waived some of the fees. So that's neat. And there are some other things about that. They crossed paths with the world's largest Viking ship. And, yeah, and Molly Solomon will have more details on that.
Oh, looking forward to hearing about that. When Nainoa Tonson was in our hallway one day, and he stopped and said, this just might happen, that we would get to go inland. And it was such an exciting thing for him just to watch his face light up talking about this and then to see it actually come to fruition and to hear some of the reports as they're moving through that journey is really exciting. So I got to ask you, arts and culture?
Absolutely. And a tie to the aina here, by the way, with food, making art a central part of a cafe or restaurant. They're doing that at the Ars Cafe on Diamond Head, featuring local artists. And that's Noe Tanigawa is going to be taking a look at that. Kelly Sueda, local painter known for some landscapes, some new work that she's showing as well. We'll be hearing about her, and her father also is in on this exhibit, which makes it kind of interesting. He's an architect, but travels the world and sketches as he goes. So some of his sketches are going to be up, and Noe's going to tell us all about that as well.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing everything that we've just talked about and more.
Oh, you bet.
We know there will be more.
You bet.
And here we are in a political cycle as things are being clearly ramped up as we're getting closer and closer to Election Day. So looking forward to hearing more from you, too.
That's true. You know, there are – it's sort of like a background. We were talking about the environmental stories and the importance of a mind frame on that. Politics, as you know, sort of continues as well. And policy considerations, not just the horse race aspects, but also what is it that we're going to do policy-wise. So we'll continue focusing on that.
That's where
as well.
A lot of the interest is, too. Thanks so much. Looking forward to all of that, and we'll talk to you next week.
You bet.
Thanks. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. Now, as we mentioned, the IUCN World Conservation Congress is moving into its final days, and members are continuing to comment on the work the Congress has produced. Earlier this morning, Director General Inger Andersen joined us in our studio to take a look back over the course of this Congress and to put it into the long and short-term context. We talked first about an issue at the heart of many in Hawaii, as it is in the around the world, the rights of indigenous peoples to steward their natural resources amid the tension of economics and politics.
What I know and have seen in the last 10, 20 years is a massive and wonderful and magnificent resurgence globally on indigenous people's issues. People have in various countries gone to court, they have gotten their rights established, they have been clear, they've gotten politically engaged, they've gotten into parliaments, wherever, in whatever country it is. And that has been critical. Also, the UN has established a forum on indigenous people and the agreements around this. All of this has allowed and facilitated that there are some basic tenets that stand internationally, globally, as well as in many countries nationally. This is not easy stuff, and some indigenous communities also do not necessarily agree on, it's not necessarily one block that wants to go in the same direction. But we are seeing a strengthening of that segment of our, in the global conversation, that important community globally, and that's very important. Indigenous peoples many times have a enhanced management practices for conservation, for sustaining the land and the sea. And that's a very important thing. And there's much for us to learn from that.
Where would you put the United States into the context of this conversation?
It's hard to say where I would put the United States. Native Americans, Native Hawaiians or Inuit people, etc., have become more organized and more vocal and are taking political positions inside their communities, as well as in public office, wherever it may be. And what I will say about Hawaii is we have had an unbelievable warm and welcoming and strong and powerful engagement with everyone here, including the Native Hawaiian communities. It's sort of the spirit of the place that has also allowed for us to have a very, very good Congress.
Looking at the Hawaii commitments and seeing where you would like us to be in 4 years when the Congress meets again, where do you place these commitments now in the overall scope of the work the Congress has done?
2015 was that year of very heavy lifting. Lots of agreements had to fall into place. These were agreements on paper. So we had the Sendai Agreement that dealt with resilience and natural disasters. We had the Addis Ababa Agreement on financing for development. We had the Sustainable Development Goals. And we had the Paris Agreement on climate, right? And this was critical. It was monumental. It was absolutely important. But these agreements were negotiated by states. IUCN is different. We are the big tent. We are that tent where states and government agencies and NGOs and scientists and indigenous people and women and all these actors come together to say, okay, now how are we going to actually shift this? So it's about creating, if you like, as many points of touch on a series of issues that needs to shift. One of the big ones is focus on the oceans. We are this island Earth, and the oceans are part and parcel. Every second breath we take comes from the oceans. And the oceans, of course, sustains the very life. And we came from the oceans. So oceans is a key issue, but there are many other areas too. We speak about nature-based solutions, meaning investing in nature's infrastructure, the mangroves, the seagrasses, the forests, the oceans in terms of protection, sand dunes, etc., wetlands, because they provide the very breathing lungs for that nature that we need. They provide us with the protection. So we've come a long way on that. And I think that there's a much greater understanding of nature-based solutions in a modern world. Thirdly, I would say figuring out and working on enhanced agricultural practices such that we can move towards a sounder basis for our agriculture and our food systems. We will soon, in 2060, be 10 billion people, and we all have to eat. So making sure that we do much sounder eco-agriculture, because we just can't pollute our soils to the extent that we have no diversity left, no pollination, no rainfall, etc.
In that balance of some of the rather scary data that we saw, there was also the direct implication that we have a great optimism of opportunity.
Exactly. And we leave this place filled with hope, determination, passion, and a belief that we are shifting the needle. Today we are, and we have to be realists, losing species 1,000 times the natural extinction rate. So all species are sort of passing through, maybe even humans. We don't have dinosaurs anymore on this good earth, and, you know, species pass through. But when we are losing species 1,000 times that natural extinction rate, then we need to be worried. But the good news is, and that's what our Red List update showed, that conservation works. I mean, actually, nature is very forgiving. If you allow nature time to bounce back, it will. And so it is a question of our will and our determination to protect what is the very foundation of our life, our sustenance, such that we can have a planet that actually hangs together sustainably. So we also were able to show, for example, that Tibetan antelope and the panda and a number of other species in our latest edition of the Red List release have actually bounced back due to conservation efforts. And whilst it's nice to talk about the nice, charismatic, furry, charming creatures like the panda, obviously, we need to understand that when we preserve the panda habitat, we're preserving everything on that habitat. But there are many things that we need to work on, from invasives to overuse, to illegal wildlife trade, to agricultural and pesticides, etc. But I think that I am seeing a growing commitment. What we need to do is to amp up that volume such that we actually can begin to have a much, much stronger engagement for biodiversity conservation across the place.
And finally, in amping up that volume, that implies greater education and education at a much earlier level. How do you see that transcending the next 10, 20 years in the way we're bringing up the next generation?
Well, I think we have to start with K-1. And I was actually delighted to have a conversation yesterday with Kamehameha Schools, because they are also very interested in this precise topic. At IUCN, we were pleased to have 900 kids from Hawaii come to the Congress and take them through a number of exhibits and have them tell us what they would want to change in their community. But we obviously need to mainstream environmental education from the simple thing. I mean, plastics, straws, single-use plastic bags. I mean, we use them for once and then 1,000 years in the landfill. That's meaningless. That is atrocious. And finally, people who are maybe post K-12, the next generation of leaders, those that are in university or in working lives now, many of them are quite well informed, but they are not necessarily able to change things because the systems are pawned. Things we buy are wrapped in all kinds of blister packs and we don't have choices. But I'm seeing already now that there are people who are simply refusing to buy these things or insisting on recycling. And these are the kind of things that we need to understand, how we, our own individual footprint, as well as our collective community, as well as our global footprint, impacts on the earth. I am seeing changes. And in my job, I have to be optimistic. And so I am, but it's not sort of foolishness optimism. I'm very realistic as well, knowing that there are real pressures. But the spirit of this Congress, with 10,000 people traveling all the way to Hawaii, staying here for 10 days, working from morning to night, and having communities behind them in the millions, this is something we've never seen before. But we will leave with a great sense of optimism and a determination from here.
Thanks so very much for joining us, Inger Anderson.
My pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Inger Anderson was appointed Director General of the International Union for Conservation of Nature in January 2015. Before that, she held various leadership roles at the World Bank and the United Nations. The IUCN World Conservation Congress comes to an end tomorrow.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Rumors Nightclub at Ala Moana Hotel, now available for private functions, offering a sound system, four giant projection screens, dance floor, and special menus for Hawaii's nonprofits. AlaMoanaHotel.com.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Lahaina Luna is a famous school on Maui, but not many realize it came about as a result of giving. It began as a gift from Kalakua Hoapili. She gave the land to American missionaries to create a high school because she saw in her people a hunger for knowledge. Lahaina Luna School was built on this land. In 1850, it was put under control of the Hawaiian monarchy, and by 1864, its graduates were the only ones considered qualified to hold government positions. It became a vocational school in 1903, and today it's the oldest high school west of the Mississippi. Lahaina Luna is a place where one can prepare for college, but perhaps more important these days, students can learn a trade useful to the community. Sure, college is important, but if you're driving around Maui and your car breaks down, who are you going to call? A PhD like me? It's more likely that the legacy of Kalakua's gift will show up with that auto service you desperately need. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
From a royal gift of Maui land for education, we move to Hawaii Island and educate you with our backyard quiz answer. We ask you how Pahala got its name. This small town in the Big Island's Kau District was originally established as a series of small self-sufficient housing camps for a nearby sugar plantation. In 1881, a public school was built there. Today, Pahala Elementary is the second oldest public school in Hawaii, and that name, Pahala, both town schools share, goes back to that plantation era. The hala tree is widespread in Kau, and when sugar workers came across volcanic cracks in the cane fields, they used to burn old hala tree leaves by stuffing them in the cracks. The resulting ash was called pahala, and that's where the name comes from. It's 8:55. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrew Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
As we're capping our week, Bill, with all of those we've talked to who journeyed here for the IUCN World Conservation Congress and who had so much to say about how many of the issues that we face in Hawaii are the broader global issues. We saw so many intersections of genius.
Exactly. What I found out was just, I don't want to be all golly gosh gee, but sometimes in the presence of real genius, you still have to be very impressed at the optimism and just the great sense of humor and the wisdom that combine. For example, Dr. Vedcharayath, who did this amazing work actually making the ripples of the sea disappear by flying drones over it, and he worked with Dr. Sylvia Earle on the paper. I had a chance to talk to her briefly this morning before she went on with you, and I asked her about that, and her eyes lit up like a child. I mean, she said, this young man gives me real hope for the future. So you see the intersection of generations of geniuses, and again, that old chestnut evil genius, no such thing. Genius solves problems. And to see them working together like that, it's just really impressive.
Well, I mean, to be true, genius can solve problems. I mean, genius in the way something, a problem is approached. But it depends on really what kind of outcome you're looking for and also what kind of motivation you have and what kind of morals are involved and all that. I mean, there's a case to be made that, yes, in fact, there might indeed be evil geniuses, too, and we've seen some of that historically. But in looking at what we see going forward with the group of people who which has joined us over the last 10 days or so and, you know, still here until tomorrow, so much optimism, but also having it grounded in reality.
Sure.
They know very much what they're up against, and the fact that we don't talk as much about how we are so dependent upon the ocean or here, unless we're talking to a group of scientists and conservationists, that we should understand that every second breath is dependent upon the ocean, as is our own livelihood for many of us, as is our own life, period.
And where there are problems, there are other points of view, but there are problems to be solved.
Well, we're going to see how some of those continue to be solved as we follow many of those issues, which are so important to all of us here in Hawaii. Now, coming up next week, we're going to get another perspective on the expansion of the Papahanaumokuakea Monument and how it will be managed.
Plus, Manoa Valley Theater gets ready to kick off its 48th season.
We'd like to hear from you, and you can be in touch anytime that you'd like. 24/7, reach this number, 808-792-8217. Just please be sure to leave us your name and your phone number and the town from which you're calling. Or, if you like, you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information on the conversation page or the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme is written for us by John DeMello. I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Join us on Monday as we pick up the conversation. Enjoy your weekend.